The village of Hobart held a town hall meeting last night on the topic of native land trusts and the desire of the Oneida Nation to start to buy back their land. But what exactly is this issue about? Do native tribes around the country really have the ability to buy land that non-native people currently live on, including eventually an entire town? What happens to the houses? What happens to municipal services? What happens to the democratically elected people who run the town? Richard Monette is a professor of law at University of Wisconsin-Madison. He's director of the Great Lakes Indigenous Law Center at UW. Monette is an expert on tribal law and the legal relationship between Native American tribes and government. Richard, welcome to the show.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm good. I'm really glad that you could come on the show today, because this is a really interesting and important topic, I think. For people who want to call in about this, 800-642-1234 is the number. Ideas@WPR.org is the email, and you can tweet us at WPR Mornings. So let's talk about this, Richard, just the basics here. What is the foundation for Hobart versus Oneida?
Well, the case actually has been boiling up for a while, and we've had several cases like it. It goes back to basically the Allotment Act, where the United States decided to divide reservations up in severalty. A lot of tribes, every tribe is unique in a way with its history and its relationship with the U.S. So the Oneida's allotment system actually goes back even farther to a treaty, as many do with many tribes. And so you had individual Native families owning land, and it wasn't clear that land ownership would remain under the governance of the tribe. And in fact, with the Allotment Act, generally, it suggested that it, after a certain period of time, it would not remain under the governance of the tribe, which meant that, of course, others began to buy it. Non-natives began to buy it. And they bought a lot with the Oneida tribe. The entire reservation was allotted in severalty into private property. And at one point, depending on who's counting, it appears that the tribe or its members owned or controlled less than 10%
wow.
of that reservation. So it's a big square on the map, but
right.
They really owned or controlled very little of it at a time.
And so how did this trust issue come so that the Oneida have the right to buy it back? And what are the parameters of buying back this land?
Yeah, again, just a bit of quick history. In that Allotment Act, across the whole country, the tribes still controlled about 150 million acres. After that Allotment Act took effect, lands were lost through being surplused or they were lost by purchase, and it was down to about 50 million when it was done.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's how Oneida lost a lot of it. Then in 1934, in the Indian Reorganization Act, Congress authorized the government to facilitate buying it back. Either the government buying it back or perhaps the tribes, although in 1934 nobody thought the tribes would be doing that. And in the interim, since 1934, Congress has allocated next to no money to do that. So what we have now, of course, is tribes like Oneida with some revenue from gaming and other sources, able to buy some of the land back themselves under that 1934 Act.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so largely that was it. Now, of course, you can fast forward up to just several years ago with the big Cobell settlement over a lot of the legal issues that arose over the loss of these lands and the management of these lands. And there was a renewed push for tribes to reacquire them.
So I would imagine, you alluded to this, but I would imagine in 1934, when this act was passed, people were like, the senators and congressmen who passed this act were like, yeah, we'll give Native Americans their land back. Sure, if we can actually buy that land. And then never really intended to do that, correct?
I think that's fair to say.
Yeah, we're taking your calls. We are talking about land trusts, specifically the Oneida Nation versus Hobart. 1-800-642-1234. You can tweet us at WPR Mornings. So let's get specifically to what's going on in Hobart. We were fascinated yesterday when we looked at a map of Hobart, Wisconsin, and it kind of overlays the Oneida Nation. It kind of cuts right through it. It is stark. It very clearly shows that the town of Hobart sits on Oneida land.
Right. It's rather unusual. You know, what we normally see is a reservation entirely surrounded by a state, and we have issues about whether the state is treating that reservation fairly, you know, closing it off economically, et cetera. We normally don't see the opposite like we see here. We see the village of Hobart claiming to have its own sort of territory, and it's entirely surrounded by the territory of the Oneida tribe. Pretty unique.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that likely came about because of one of those allotments got acquired. Probably several of them got acquired, but one of them likely turned into a township, turned into a municipal area, and got developed. And somebody decided somewhere along the line to incorporate under the state. And so we end up with a town or a village inside the reservation of the Oneida tribe.
Hmm.
Very interesting.
That is very interesting. So what do the Oneida want to do?
Well, the Oneida want to reacquire their lands back, first of all. They want to reacquire their territory. Governance is territorial. That's the problem here as well. I'm sorry. I'm by a window.
Got it.
Governance is territorial. So all of these matters that are giving rise to these cases, like utility fees or zoning of abandoned railroad beds, or in this case, permitting for festivals, parades, etc. You know, these things are territorial. And so these kinds of fights are not going to go away. And Oneida wants to be able to govern those things as much as any other sovereign wants to be able to govern them. That's how they determine, you know, their life ways. That's how they determine what kind of activities and events will happen in their communities. It helps to determine their culture, etc. So we have Hobart sort of invoking as a political subdivision of the state of Wisconsin, territorial sort of governance, and we have Oneida invoking territorial governance, and it happens to be over the same territory.
Right.
Right.
Again, though, are people buying back some of the allotments? Oneida people are buying back some of the allotments. But what is Oneida's ultimate goal there?
Well, they want to put land, what's called, into trust, right? And that's kind of a squishy concept. At its most native view, it's basically saying the territory is in trust, meaning the territory is part of this political relationship with the United States, and it doesn't matter who owns what within it, tribal member, non-member, corporation, business, a school, it doesn't matter. Now, at the other end, people simply see that, sort of the most non-native view that the law is basically stuck in, that it takes it out of fee status, takes it out of the property status under the state and under Hobart, puts it in a trust status, non-taxable by the state or the city, and so cuts into the city's tax base the way they see it, and it then ends the city and the state's jurisdiction over it, and it becomes the jurisdiction of the Oneida tribe.
The village of Hobart obviously doesn't particularly want this. They have built a city or town around native land. What are they saying?
Well, again, they what we hear is a lot of issues here, but we hear, you know, that about when it goes into trust, it gets a tax-exempt status. Now, that's rather short-sighted because somewhere along the line, the Oneida tribe is a government, and it also might tax this land. But you tax territorially, so if Oneida reacquired enough of it, it may also tax. So it's not about tax exempt. It sends the wrong message.
Right,
to people
right.
Thinking about natives and they don't pay taxes. It's not about whether you pay taxes. It's about to whom you pay taxes, to which government. And most people, of course, want to pay taxes to their own government, right? So, but if there are non-natives, not Oneida people living there in Hobart and paying taxes to Hobart, it in fact cuts into the tax base of the village of Hobart.
Okay, so we're gonna explore that when we come back. Do you live on reservation land? Are you enrolled in a member of a tribe? What do you want people to know about this issue? Are you near tribal land? How do you work with tribal leaders to bridge the gap between your community and theirs? Call us at 1-800-642-1234. We are exploring Native American trusts in Wisconsin with Richard Monette. It's The Morning Show. It's The Morning Show. I'm Carrie Kaufman. We're talking about Native American land trusts and the Oneida Nation's dispute with the village of Hobart. Richard Monette is walking us through an issue that seems as thorny as the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. We're also taking your calls on this. Call us at 800-642-1234. Ideas at WPR.org is the way you can email us, and you can tweet at WPR Mornings. Richard, I want to talk about a little bit about where they're jockeying now. There was a Hobart town hall. Hobart is a town within the Oneida Nation, as we established just a few minutes ago, literally sitting within the Oneida Nation. So what happens if the Oneida say, hey, we want sovereignty over this land. People own houses there. Can they have their houses taken away? What about utilities? What about zoning laws? All of those things.
Well, it depends on whether it's going into trust or not. The Oneida tribe is not going to take anybody's land. It doesn't have the authority necessarily to do that. If it did, it would get the authority, just like any government, from those over whom it would exercise governance. And nobody's really authorized that. In my own view, even the Oneida people have not authorized their government to take land, presumably even to pay fair market value for it. So that's really not on the table. And I hope that kind of a scare tactic is not being bandied about.
I've heard that. So that's good to know.
Well, let's be fair. I mean, there are equities on both sides here. There are fundamental fairnesses on both sides. But let's also be fair. Most of the people bought land in Hobart knowing full well that they were within the exterior boundaries of a recognized Indian reservation. So they're not, without dirty hands a bit as well. So, but nonetheless, this is an issue. Like I said, governance is territorial, and it's not going to go away. And so what do we do? What the point you're making is how we're sort of getting down into the dirt, and we're getting Hobart saying they're going to take our lands away, they're going to kick us off, they're not going to pay us fair market value, and so they attack in kind. They are saying the Oneida tribe is not a federally recognized tribe. They're saying that its reservation was disestablished or at least diminished by that allotment act and that allotment process, which really cuts to the existence of the tribe. So those are pretty, low and hard blows.
Right.
And they may, gain traction, frankly. And the Oneida tribe, then I assume, will respond in kind. And it's not like they're without a few arrows in their quiver as well. Frankly, I've been very surprised that the Oneida tribe has not issued a charter, passed a law, an Oneida Nation law, authorizing the issuance of charters for cities and towns, municipalities, and then issue one to Hobart to make it clear that while Hobart is a village, it's a village under the jurisdiction of the Oneida tribe, right? I mean, there's a lot of posturing and interesting things that can and will continue here if this isn't resolved.
We've got Tina from Pulaski. Tina, welcome to the program.
Hi, thank you. I just wanted to give a little information to the listeners who maybe don't have any idea where this is in the state. Hobart is a piece of is a village that butts up right up to the city of Green Bay, and it's also it's a fairly wealthy city. We have a lot of there's very large homes in that area. There's a very nice golf course I believe that the Oneida Tribe now owns the golf course in that area that they had bought back. But it's a very big tax revenue stream for our school district, which is Pulaski, which those students go to Pulaski. So as we look at kind of the area, I just kind of wanted to let listeners know this is where it is. It's right up to Green Bay, and it is a very high stream tax revenue for the school district. And that would be a question I had, like what would happen if it went into trust with revenues for the local school district then?
That is, stay on the line, Tina. I want to come back to you. That is a great question. What would happen if it went into trust? What would happen to the revenues for the school district?
They would diminish accordingly.
Yeah.
Those taxes would not be collected by the state or the school district, and they would not be available to the school district. That's why this is a huge issue that requires at some point the tribe, the state of Wisconsin, the village of Hobart, and while they're at it, Ashwaubenon and Green Bay, to sit down and figure out what they're going to do. Now, you know, there could be exchanges of land, perhaps of equal amount or at least equal value. The tribe and the United States, since the United States is not without dirty hands here as well, they might offer payments in lieu of taxes, at least over a period of time, so that the school district might, compensate for that. But this is going to take a lot of thinking, a lot of compromise, and a lot of courage to do this. These are the exact kinds of huge issues, real equities, real people, families, children, property, businesses at stake. And this little, these kinds of fabricated, and I'm going to go ahead and throw that out there, almost fabricated sort of lawsuits to test the elasticity and the boundaries of each other's will is not helping, I don't think.
Tina, I wonder, first of all, what are the demographics of Hobart, of the area? Do you know?
Well, there's a few very large subdivisions in Hobart. And it's on beautiful land, and there are very large homes in that area in Hobart, and it's expanding all the time. There's some multifamily homes that just went up, but they're very high, and like townhouses, multifamily homes like that. I grew up in this area. I lived here when there was nothing there, and I can see the huge difference that the building in Hobart has very much changed the dynamics, you know, and it has kind of, you know, I'm very rural. I came from a very rural part outside of that area, so a smaller farming community. And then we look inside of Hobart, and there's still some of that there. There's still some family farms and that. But there are these bigger subdivisions with very large, wealthy homes or, you know, people that have a higher level income that are paying very high taxes for those homes.
So my producer gave me some numbers. 2010 census, this is a little outdated, shows that Hobart had less than 8,000 people. 79.9% were white, 12% were native residents. Are you saying that these big homes were built just in the last couple of decades?
Oh, absolutely. They were built in the last couple of decades. I am 48 years old. None of this was there when I went to high school in the 80s. None of this was there. And I would like to say it probably started mid-90s, maybe. That is when a lot of this building started with these very, you know, these larger homes in that type of area. It's an attractive area because it's more rural, but it's very close to Ashwaubenon and Green Bay. And it's very near Lambeau Field, so that's always an attractive
right.
people to that area. And that is, it's just a very attractive area for families to move into. It's also considered a very safe area to live in. The school district is considered a very good school district. So that's the attraction, I think, to people moving into that area. Besides, it's beautiful land.
Right.
There's some hillies, and they're very flat.
Right.
So
I was driving through there a few weeks ago. It is very beautiful land. What's the sense of people that you know who live in the area to this issue? Or are they even aware of this issue?
I was not aware of this until I heard the program today. So I do not know anybody who has ever brought this up. For your listeners to know too, Hobart also, there's a small town that's called Oneida, and that's right, you know, of course, it butts right up to Hobart, too, and that town has changed over the years, too, you know, with the income that the tribe is now getting from the gaming and other sources. They've been able to really improve their area, too.
Right, right.
So it's a very, you know, it's a beautiful little community, all of that is, and I hope that it gets resolved in the right way. But I can see both sides of it, so I just hope it gets resolved in the right way.
Tina, thank you very much for talking with us. We appreciate it. We're back with Richard Monette talking about this issue of the Oneida Tribe and Hobart. Richard, so school district money will go away. Taxes for school districts will go away, but that can be worked out. Are you seeing the village actually wanting to sit down? Tina seemed pretty reasonable here about, I hope we can work this out. Are you seeing village leaders being that reasonable?
It seems, and I'm sure Hobart has reasonable people. It also seems that with the onslaught of lawsuits, very consistent over the last 20 to 30 years, frankly, that reason doesn't prevail at the top. And it would be high time to do that. You know, the tribe also has schools. I'm sure those children would be allowed into the tribe's schools. Perhaps there would be some combined schools. You know, if the people really want to continue to pay taxes and keep their homes, they could pay taxes to the tribe or to the tribe's school. I'm sure all of this can be worked out.
Right. The money would just funnel through the tribe rather than the local government or the county government, correct?
And that could be one model that would be very workable, along with obviously several models that could be workable. So I don't mean to question her genuine feelings about her community, etc. In fact, it appears that the people in Hobart, if I might say so a little tongue-in-cheek, are very tribal. they care a lot about their little village, and,
right.
and they intend to build a wall around it, apparently. But, you know, some of them obviously also have been willing to sell. And if the tribe is going to offer more than fair market value, I imagine people are going to continue to sell.
And is the tribe offering more than fair market value at this point?
My understanding is that it has tried to stick to fair market value, but on occasion it has offered more. And let's not forget the bit of irony here, because if you're a non-native living there and you get two buyers coming in and one of them is the Oneida Tribe, your price goes up.
Mm.
That's just fair to say. And so, in fact, some people might say that some people are knowingly buying and building there because they know that the tribe is going to pay top dollar at some time soon.
So you think, so that's our, Tina was talking about the fact that a lot of these large subdivisions have been built in the last 20 years. Do you think that they were doing it because they were ignorant of the idea that the Oneida had claims to this land? Or do you think that they were doing it to sell to the Oneida down the road?
I think that both of those are possibilities. There's a third possibility that they were doing it just to get into this kind of a battle. And maybe a couple of other possibilities. But do I think that some people did it knowingly? Yes, I do. And does that sort of undermine their equities a bit? Yes, it does. You know, we don't expect people to reason about things that they don't know, but many of these people did know. And they chose this, you know, of their own accord, and now they're stuck in this boat. Now, again, you know, the word on the street is at least a few people say, you know, I was okay with it because the Oneida tribe is going to pay me more than fair market value at some time in the very near future. It's sort of like an investment, sort of like you buy a house thinking, well, I'm going to sell it for more in 10 or 15 years. This is the same thing, but I'm not just going to sell it in 10 or 15 years. I'm going to get more than it's worth. Mm. And I don't think there's a doubt that some of that is at play. Now, that's not to paint everybody that way.
Right, right.
So are there some people that see a beautiful place? Well, of course, that's why the Oneida tribe wanted to live there, because
right.
It's a beautiful place. And so do they see all the amenities and benefits? Of course. But to suggest almost that anybody has moved there in the last 20 years without knowing about this, that to me is disingenuous. I mean, plug in Hobart, Village of Hobart versus Oneida Nation, and you have a difficult time finding the case in front of us about the Big Apple Fest.
Yes.
Because first you have to get through cases about utility fees and railroad lines and all kinds of other things. This has been going on for a long time.
So there are a lot of lawsuits that you think are there to gum up the works.
Well, I think that's probably the purpose of some, but one thing is beyond doubt, it is in fact having that effect, right? And so it's going to take some real gumption and willpower and courage to sit down to fix this, and it should happen sooner than later, or people on both sides are going to pay the price.
I should note that we did reach out to officials at the Village of Hobart to be on this show. We tried to get somebody there yesterday to the town hall meeting. We couldn't do that. We would love to talk to people from the Village of Hobart, even now, even after this show, to find out what their side is, and we could do something else on this. So let's talk about local government service agreements between the tribes. Is there any agreement at all between the city and the tribe?
I'm not sure how formal they are. So, and perhaps I should start out with I don't know.
Okay.
My understanding is there are agreements, and at least informal agreements, certainly with emergency services, police, and other public, you know,
right.
fire services, etc. And, you know, that would just continue, even if there's a push toward making this territorial. You still have, as she said, the little town of Oneida next to Hobart. You have the reservation there. Those kinds of things would continue and probably be easier to do if this could be worked out.
We are talking to Richard Monette. He's taking us through issues at stake in a dispute between the Oneida Nation and the Village of Hobart. Give us a call, 800-642-1234. Right now, we have Eugene from Viola. Eugene, welcome to the program.
Good morning. I was teaching Rosebud Indian Reservation in the 1970s. I was out there for 5 years. And the anytime any land came up for sale, the tribe had first dibs at it.
Mm-hmm.
They could buy it first, pretty much. And another thing they had out there was jurisdiction. For instance, the city of Mission sits 1 mile square. Well, that's not part of the reservation. So what the tribe did out there, they cross-deputized.
Right.
With the white police officers and also the tribal police, pretty much. Another one that happened when I was there was State Patrol was coming down and sitting on Highway 18 and writing tickets. Well, the Indians couldn't afford to pay the tickets, so the tribe was paying it. Well, they ran that through the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court ruled that State Patrol couldn't come down there and sit and write any more tickets.
Okay, Eugene, thank you very much. Richard, the town police officers, perhaps, and the Oneida police officers working together?
They do so now. I'm
okay.
Quite certain they do, and in fact, I'm quite certain on the ground they do so rather professionally, as they have to. You know, we're still talking about real law enforcement issues and safety, etc.
Richard Monette is taking us through issues at stake in a dispute between the Oneida Nation and the Village of Hobart. We're going to dig a little deeper in a moment, find out maybe how other municipalities have dealt with this. It's The Morning Show. It's the Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Carrie Kaufman. We're talking about Native American land trusts and a heated dispute between the village of Hobart and the Oneida Nation. 1-800-642-1234. We would love to take your calls on this. Ideas@WPR.org. Tweet us at WPR Mornings. Richard Monette is with us, talking us through these issues. And Richard, I want to, we've talked about the history of this. The Oneida tribe and the village of Hobart are not the only areas that have dealt with this. How have other towns and native lands dealt with this previously?
Well, you know, the best analogies are actually out of state, but we do have a couple sort of analogies in state. Now, I say sort of because most of the towns on the Indian reservations are, you know, growing and evolving by the Indians themselves.
Mm-hmm.
So and certainly there are non-natives there. They may be doctors and lawyers or teachers, or they may be just people married in. Generally, they're a minority. They're there knowing where they are and why they're there. But so you might think about maybe Odana, certainly Kashina on Menominee, but just not these kinds of issues. And in particular, this idea of having a non-native purchase an allotment inside the exterior boundaries of a reservation, turning it into a town. We do have similar things in the state of Washington. And in fact, we had a case go to the U.S. Supreme Court where the Yakima tribe attempted to zone basically a town in the reservation that had grown over the years. And the Supreme Court came down with a terrible decision for everybody, largely because it had no majority. It was a plurality. And it had this distinction about an open part of a reservation and a closed part of a reservation. And 30 years later, nobody knows what that means. So does the Oneida tribe have a closed part or an open part? I don't know.
Mm.
I can't say that for sure, and I don't really know anybody who can. My prevailing view is that they mean a part that was opened to homesteading. After all the Indians got their allotments, there were significant chunks of land left, and the United States opened that for homesteading. That was the case on the reservation in Washington in Yakima, and so I think that's the meaning of that. That is not the case at Oneida, so you would say that Oneida is more likely to be a closed reservation, although it's difficult to argue that when they, frankly, their members sold so much of it and or lost it through intermarriage, et cetera.
Right.
So what we have in those kinds of towns, and there are very few, it's unique, maybe Browning, Montana, to a certain extent, on the Blackfeet Reservation. They have, as the word that one of the callers used, the cross-deputization mechanism, or the tribe simply contributing, paying in lieu of taxes is the phrase we often hear. Of course, we hear of tribes, including like Ho-Chunk there in the state, buying ambulances, buying fire trucks for the local towns in exchange for services, et cetera. So, you know, it's not complicated to want to do this, to sit down and say, where is our middle ground? And let's decide what we want at the outer edges. You know, we want some of our land back. We want trust and all that. But in the interim, what do we do to facilitate, life going on as it should, protecting property, protecting lives, protecting our equities? And it's really not impossible. We see a lot of entities doing this. And we had a big case in New Mexico that I actually was called on a lot, where a subdivision had developed on one of the Pueblo lands north of Santa Fe, and they sat down. They had lawsuits, but they sat down, and the road to the subdivision is now relatively isolated, which is the way the subdivision wanted it.
Mm.
Pueblo, the tribe, is now building a road around it, so they can, you know, use that part of the reservation and get there. The non-natives are going to be able to stay there. They may have negotiated something like the caller said, where the tribe would perhaps purchase a first right of refusal to buy. They generally have that anyway if it's trust land being sold, which is probably what the caller was talking about. But if it's non-trust land, which you have at Hobart, the tribe doesn't have a right of first refusal there. But they could negotiate that into an agreement.
So they don't have that. So if I live in Hobart and I want to sell my house and I get two buyers, I don't have to sell the Oneida.
You do not.
Interesting. Okay.
Yeah.
So I can. That was the confusing part to me earlier when you were saying that it could be a fight and the value of their house could go up if the Oneida get involved.
Right.
Okay.
That's right.
So in terms of you draft a lot of constitutions for Native nations, what is different about the constitutions that you're drafting? And are you taking into account the area that generally surrounds, not is embedded in, the reservations?
I am. I mean, the main thing that the United States has done to Indian tribes is try to limit their sovereignty to their people, a popular sovereignty, we call it, and try to basically quash their sovereignty over territory and property. It's as simple as that. And so these territorial sort of things, like a tribe issuing a charter of incorporation, like a tribe establishing its own private property system, would instantly halt a lot of this kind of activity that's happening on other reservations. It's not happening. Hobart is maybe feeling like a victim, but on most reservations, the it's still going in the other direction. We still have non-Indians moving in, tribes selling their trust land, their members selling their trust land. And so dealing with their tribes as territories, the tribes assuming control of property there, you know, sales, abstracting, surveys, appraisals, you know, just everything that that we do with property that generates revenue and value, that has been taken from the tribes for 200 years. And it's time for them to do that. And if they, and Oneida is one of the tribes that has started to do that. So it literally basically issues a patent or a title to tribal members now in their territory, as it should. And it should be clear that that title is held, issued by the Oneida tribe, held under the governance of the Oneida tribe. And that's why Oneida is really, so far, winning this argument, because they've done this with legal and commercial infrastructure.
We've been, I got to cut you off there. Talking about this really thorny issue of Native American land trusts and clashes between tribes and towns that sit on reclaimed land. Hobart, Wisconsin is one such town that is literally in the reservation of Oneida. The town hall meeting last night. They are not really happy about this, and we would love to talk to them about this. Richard Monette is a professor of law at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. He's director of the Great Lakes Indigenous Law Center at UW. Monette is an expert on tribal law and the legal relationship between Native American tribes and the government. Thank you, Richard, for helping us figure this out today.
Terry, my pleasure.
In our ongoing series this election year, we're spotlighting gubernatorial candidates. Today, it's Malon Mitchell. He became head of the Wisconsin Firefighters Union the year Scott Walker was elected governor. That made a name for himself as a fiery speaker during the Capitol protest in 2011. And today, he's running to replace Walker as governor. Sean Johnson has this profile.
Malon Mitchell was just 33 years old when Scott Walker introduced the bill now known as Act 10 to restrict the bargaining rights of most public sector unions. To hear Mitchell describe it, he didn't have much experience in public speaking. But when tens of thousands of protesters started showing up at the Capitol, Mitchell got his chance.
How are we doing out there? I can't hear you. How are we doing out there?
Mitchell had a knack for reading crowds and feeding off their energy.
And to show you that the firefighters are with you, if there was any doubt, we're going to make sure there is no doubt tonight, because the firefighters are going to sleep in the Capitol tonight.
Firefighters were exempt from most of Act 10. Just being there a week after the bill was introduced was a show of solidarity. It's not Mitchell's only connection to Walker. They grew up in the same small town, Delavan, and graduated from high school about a decade apart. Kevin Hembrook was one of Mitchell's close friends in high school.
If you could find someone that didn't like Malon Mitchell in that class, good luck, because I'm pretty sure that he was well-liked by everybody.
Hembrook followed Mitchell to Madison and to firefighting. He remembers watching his friend during the 2011 protests.
I'm getting goosebumps just thinking about it again because of the way he would speak and the praise that he would get from the people in the crowd.
Mitchell says he didn't grow up in a union household. He went to culinary school but quit after a year to become a firefighter because his older brother made it sound fun. He says he got more involved in the union after a fellow firefighter in Madison was left paralyzed in an off-duty snowmobile crash. The union raised money for the firefighter and stayed active in his life until he died more than a decade later.
And that's the catalyst that made me get in a union, because I said I would be part of that, part of something that's basically bigger than yourself.
Mitchell has endorsements from the AFL-CIO, Ask Me, and a road building union that endorsed Scott Walker in his first run for governor. But Wisconsin unions are weaker than they were before Walker signed Act 10 and later right to work for private sector unions. James Feigenbaum is an assistant professor of economics at Boston University who has studied how the passage of right to work laws affect the power of unions to influence elections. In short, he says the laws leave Democrats worse off with fewer rank and file union members to get out the vote.
It would not surprise me at all that sort of a weakened labor movement or weakened organized labor would have a harder time sort of making their endorsements really count.
Mitchell has embraced unions but says he's not just the labor candidate. In his speeches today, he reminds crowds that they could make history with his candidacy. He'd be Wisconsin's first ever African-American governor. Mitchell has the endorsement of Congresswoman Gwen Moore. She says Democrats have been too cautious in previous campaigns against Walker.
We're always so calculating about this. Oh, can we find a self-funder? We need somebody with money. Oh, can we find someone who's moderate that can appeal to the people up north?
Moore says this year Democrats should support someone who, quote, has their heart. For her, that's Mitchell.
I need somebody who is on fire, and that was a firefighter.
Mitchell ran an unsuccessful campaign for lieutenant governor in the 2012 recall election. He remembers the exact number of votes he got when he came up short. The recall raised Walker's national profile and dealt a blow to unions. Mitchell wants to return the favor in November. Sean Johnson, Wisconsin Public Radio.
You can hear another candidate profile on Monday at this time. Our coverage doesn't stop there. Stick with us this morning as we wade into the relationship between media and primary candidates. Who should get to debate? How should journalists cover a wide gubernatorial field? And what political messages could work in these circumstances? You're listening to The Morning Show. I'm Carrie Kaufman on the Ideas Network.